Tanasta Lean, and welcome to the Feminine Podcast, where we talk about everything in between, a little bit of femme, and a little bit of EM. This is Risa E. Lewis, host for the Feminine Podcast, and today I have my co-host,
Amy Zidin, wing woman, back again.
For our third episode together. So audience, today is dedicated to the number three, just like Sesame Street. We're going to dedicate it to a number, three, because it's our third episode together. But more importantly, letters are going to take precedent over numbers today. We're going to talk about our episode being dedicated to the letter A. A meaning?
Advocacy.
Advocacy, also Amy, but correct. The small letter will be Amy, the big letter will be advocacy. We have two guests that are moving the needle, making a difference, making a mark in this world. Our two guests are
Sion Ferrer,
Alyssa Gutman.
So Alyssa and Sion are our two guests. Let's start by asking them to introduce themselves and tell audience so you can hear about them. Alyssa, go.
Hi, Risa. I am a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Penn, and I'm an attending psychiatrist in the Philadelphia VA, and I'm medical director of the Philadelphia Human Rights Clinic, which is a clinic in Philadelphia run by medical students that provides pro bono physical and psychiatric evaluations for asylum seekers in the Philadelphia area. My background is that I am an MD-PhD with my PhD in neuroscience. I studied the neurobiology underlying anxiety and post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm a physician, a psychiatrist. And I came back to Philadelphia to come do my residency at Penn. I stayed for a forensic fellowship, where I was privileged to have mentorship from Dr. Bob Sadoff, who is one of the fathers of forensic psychiatry. And from there, I stayed in Philadelphia at Penn and at our VA, working largely with individuals who've experienced trauma and also working with serious mental illness.
Fantastic. Now, in the emergency department, we are witness and take care of patients at all different stages of trauma. Usually, people think of trauma, audience members may think of trauma in terms of actual musculoskeletal, car, bicycle, pedestrian trauma, but we're talking about a little bit of a different type of trauma. We'll get back to that. Sion, tell us about yourself.
Okay, thank you, Risa. So I was born and raised in Ethiopia. I grew up partially here in the U.S. I grew up in the South and went to college in Georgia. I came to New York for medical school and I've been here since then. I work as an emergency physician clinically at Columbia University. I'm also an assistant professor of emergency medicine. And my other title is I also work for the government of Ethiopia as an advisor to the Minister of Health of Ethiopia on emergency medicine and also strategic partnership. I did a fellowship in international emergency medicine at Columbia University with also a public health master's, and I decided to stay there as an attending, and I do split my time between New York and Ethiopia, and I continue to also work here with medical students and residents and at the same time work for the government of Ethiopia.
And when you're in Ethiopia, is most of your work in the capital city, Addis Ababa, or outside?
So mostly it's in Addis, but I do travel outside depending on the current status of what specific projects I'm working on. I would say for the past few months that I've traveled to Ethiopia, I've had the opportunity to travel to other regions because there were issues related to internally displaced people and visiting different sites, campsites for the displaced people. And also, I do work on emergency capacity building, so I do get the chance to visit different hospitals and sites to evaluate how their emergency medicine, the provision of emergency medicine, and also to train different providers in emergency care.
So since this podcast is dedicated to the letter A, I'm allowed to say this, but these women are badasses.
They are. So is that the letter B or that's the letter A?
It's both.
Oh, B-A. Oh, okay. I got it. Fantastic. And, you know, we may or may not have provided our guests with some questions to prepare ahead of time, or at least to think about. And one question I posed that I'm going to pose now. And Sian, why don't you take it first? Alyssa, take it second. How would you define advocacy?
So for me, advocacy is really being the voice for the voiceless, and using the privilege that you have, or you may not know that you have, to speak on behalf of the non-privileged. In the long run, I think it's also helping the voiceless become the voice and the force of change. And eventually, I think at some point in our life, we all had to advocate for members of our family or the community or the population. But for me, advocacy, again, is about being the voice for voiceless, and it's something I had to learn over time.
Alyssa, what about you?
Well, that's a beautiful and poetic answer, so one could not beat that. So I'll nerd it up a little bit instead. So I'd say that advocacy is using expertise to bring attention to a problem or a cause. And it's actually an interesting question to ask a forensic psychiatrist in particular, because I can't actually be an advocate in the asylum work that I do. It's considered a dirty word in forensic work. So in the traditional sense where an attorney might be an advocate, or as physicians doing treatment work, we can advocate for our patients, I have to have the same answer regardless of who asks me to testify as an expert witness. I have to be an objective evaluator who can see the situation and come to my clinical assessment without it being clouded. So my advocacy is done through objectivity in forensics.
When did each of you feel the calling to participate in this work? You know, was it as a child? Was it because of what you saw in your family? Was it Sian, where you grew up? You know, when did it hit you? I will say personally, my advocacy, or my recognizing myself in this, under this umbrella, has come through Feminem and come through Time's Up Healthcare. So it's come a bit later, even though it was always inside me, and now is at a point that it's ready to be voiced. Where did you first find your voice regarding advocacy?
I don't know if there was any specific time or incident that actually felt like I was all of a sudden an advocate, but I would say growing up between different cultures, I was able to witness what's fair and what's not fair, even as a child. And I think when I realized that I had a voice is when I probably felt like I can actually advocate and using my voice. And that probably came sometime when I was in college. I went to a predominantly white college down south, and witnessing the number of underrepresented minorities in college and the lack of diversity. And all of a sudden, I found myself being involved in working towards the recruitment of underrepresented minorities, and especially working on retention of underrepresented minorities through college. And eventually, I guess when I came to medical school, also I've noticed that lack of underrepresented minorities in college. I met in medical school into a residency. And I would also say eventually why I got involved in international work and being able to advocate for emergency medicine in general.
It's a little bit of an appetizer of a major historic event that happened over the last week. So hold on that thought.
Okay. And then I was just going to add that I think I would say at some point during residency and fellowship, I've realized that having been trained in the U.S. that I had so much of a privilege in emergency medicine, because it was a specialty that's been around for over 50, 60 years in the U.S. And that was not the case so much when I traveled to other parts of the world, where emergency medicine was still something of a novelty to most of physicians or to most of the politicians. So I think during that transition and traveling throughout the rest of the world, that's when I realized that having trained in the U.S. that can actually advocate for emergency medicine using the experience that I've built in the U.S.
For me, I was a graduate student in neuroscience. I was an MD PhD student, so I was a professional medical student. I was in medical school for 10 years. And I can't remember exactly which time I was getting peed on by a rat that I was wondering why I had gone in that direction, but it was one of those times. And I went into medical school and into an MD-PhD program with very high goals, thinking that doing that and having the dual degree, I could potentially change the world and cure a disease. And then the millionth time I was peed on, I felt concerned that I was stuck in.
I'm concerned.
Right?
I hate rats. I can't.
The Sprague dollies are lovely, so you shouldn't hate them all.
Yeah, I will always have these visions of you, Alyssa, being peed on by a rat and apologizing to the rat because you're that
kind.
Yeah,
that's about how it went. But there was an awakening in me during graduate school when I went to a conference and had the pleasure of hearing a talk from a Sudanese lost boy. So a refugee from Sudan who had come to America. And as a graduate student in neuroscience studying post-traumatic stress disorder, I was incredibly well-versed in the literature. It was a time when I knew the literature backwards and forwards about every neuropeptide involved in the systems, every circuit involved. And yet I had very limited human contact with what it meant to experience and live through trauma. And the talk was eye-opening, life-changing in many ways. And I found myself returning to Atlanta looking for some way to do something more, to be more active. I had been perhaps passive as a graduate student in some ways and felt like I needed to find something else. And in serendipity, a fellow MD-PhD student had just started the Atlanta Asylum Network, which was an undergraduate and graduate student-run asylum clinic in the Atlanta area. I became involved in that group and started really doing the behind-the-scenes work, not so much the shiny work because I hadn't finished medical school yet. And when I came to Philadelphia, I was seeking a similar organization to become involved in, but there wasn't one. And so I founded one with a group of medical students at Penn, now partnering with Drexel and Jefferson as well.
That's excellent. And Amy, that's how you were involved, correct?
Exactly. I had started some asylum work with my mentor, Hope Ferdosian, in medical school. And then this little shining angel appeared when I moved to Philadelphia with Alyssa, who had, like she said, founded this incredible organization that expanded so much while I was there during residency to include multiple different schools, a home site, and beyond. So I was very lucky to have her mentor me there and continue to mentor me.
And so, Amy, for the emergency medicine audience listeners, if wondering, like, how were you involved, and was this connected to working in the emergency department, or is disconnected? Is there any sort of connection you can provide?
That's a great question. So the connection for me was trauma. And as emergency medicine physicians, I think we are experts at evaluating trauma. And sometimes we don't think of that. Sometimes that trauma is acute, but sometimes that's subacute or chronic. And so that was an expertise that I felt like I was learning. And here was another population that needed us to help evaluate for traumatic injuries. And so it seemed like a very natural home for me. And when I then met Alyssa and I started getting doing more evaluations, I realized we need more emergency medicine providers doing this. And so my goal now is to try to get and recruit more emergency medicine providers to help with the physical evaluations in evaluating for trauma.
Where in the United States are some of the more established or organized asylum communities where healthcare providers listening to our program can get involved?
I think that emergency medicine physicians can get involved in any community. So it's an interesting world where refugee communities are distributed around the country in places that we may not expect. Asylum communities would be a little bit different. So asylum seekers are coming into the U.S. in some way, either via a legal pathway or coming as an undocumented immigrant. And
I'm going to stop you. Actually, assume our audience doesn't know the difference, because some people I think may think refugee and asylum is the same. I've been learned by the three of you that it's not. So make believe we don't know the definitional difference. I just made up that word, definitional.
I like that word.
Tell us about the difference between an asylum seeker versus a refugee.
Yeah. So a refugee is a person who has been displaced in some way from their home country and has crossed an international frontier into another country. Refugees, when we use that word is considered something particular. It's defined in UN law. And refugees, when they come to another country, come there with a certain status and an immigration status. In the US, someone comes with an immigration status that is a pathway to citizenship. An asylum seeker is an individual who crosses that international frontier either in a documented fashion, having some sort of a temporary visa, such as a student visa or a travel visa, or someone who comes in an undocumented manner and crosses that frontier. And the asylum seeker is then asking whatever country they've arrived in for the status of a refugee under UN law. And asylum seekers are typically seeking that status based on having been persecuted in their home country and proving that they cannot return to their home country on the basis of something that they cannot or should not have to change about themselves.
Got it. Helpful.
I think too, Risa, there are over probably now 17, I think, medical student run asylum clinics, and they do happen to be in some big cities, and we can put that list, a link to the list in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. On the show notes. I love saying an audience. You'll see that in the show notes. Although I was speaking with one of my podcast, one of my experienced podcast friends recently who said, yeah, no one goes to the show notes. So I was a little deflated.
I go to the show notes. So okay. I will. All right. But for anybody else who is interested, they can contact any of Alyssa, myself, Risa, and we can get them in contact with individuals we may know because we have quite between Alyssa and I think we have quite the national community with our asylum colleagues.
And asylum seekers would be anywhere in the country. So refugees are resettled in a particular city that is determined by the federal government before someone arrives in the U.S. And asylum seekers may pop up anywhere. So they may find a community of refugees that is from their home country because people tend to know someone who knows someone and go place to place based on that. Many asylum seekers might be at borders, but we actually have a lot of asylum seekers in the Philadelphia area, and we're not at a border.
Right. Sion, I'm going to pivot, and I have been using that word pivot. I really like the word pivot. I want to pivot to Sion and tell us the conversation we've just been having, some of these definitions, how that intersects with the work you're doing in Ethiopia, and specifically bring up what just happened with the WHO in Geneva.
Okay. So most of, I guess, what we talked about is really when it comes to advocacy, and what you, Amy, and Alyssa talked about is really becoming the voice for the voiceless. And what we've been doing, I guess, in Ethiopia when the discussion of emergency medicine is being able to advocate at international level. Just like I said earlier, emergency medicine in other parts of the world is not a specialty that's recognized. And there are a lot of people who every day who are providing emergency care, either at the pre-hospital level or a hospital level, and who do not get the formal recognition. So I would say for me, it started about 10 years ago when I went back to Ethiopia as a medical student. And at that point, the program there, the emergency medicine residency, was just starting. And I ran into this few residents who are really dedicated to strengths in emergency care in their country, the hospital. But imagine how it was like in this country when it first started. You would call your consul, the consuls, and they'll be like, who are you? And what's emergency medicine? Not only do you have...
Was this the Black Lion Hospital in Addis?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. That's where they started the residency first. And eventually, you know, every day this residence rose above the everyday challenges besides just advocating for their patients, but really trying to explain what emergency medicine is and also advocating for the specialty while advocating for the patients. So I would say coming back here and starting my residency, you know, most of that challenge was overcome by the people that started emergency medicine specialty here in the U.S. And when I do go back, I kept on going back with the resources that I have from the U.S., whether it's books, whether it's lecture materials, and I continue to do so. But over time, I did realize that most of the challenge can only be overcome by involving higher level officials, which are the ministers of health, the minister of transport, the police commissioners, all those things. So that's how I ended up really getting involved in advocacy work at a higher level outside of just the hospital, because I felt like real change could only come when there are policies and procedures in place. So I ended up going back as a volunteer at the Ministry of Health when I was doing my master's in public health. And I did get some exposure to what was happening at a national level. So since I went back since then, I've had to knock on the doors of 3 different ministers. And all of them had different views about emergency care. One really wanted to focus on injury. One really wanted to focus on the pre-hospital care. And the others really wanted to approach emergency care transformation from bottom up. So eventually, over time, at a national level, it was a specialty that was recognized. And eventually, we were able to bring this to international level. We changed some of our policies. That way, emergency care was embedded as an essential part of what we call universal health coverage. And when we spoke to the minister about a year ago about proposing a resolution at the UN level, which is at the World Health Organization, and having Ethiopia be a champion of what we learned through the collaboration work that we have done with WHO and through different partners, he was very excited about it. So the last time any resolution that was passed through the WHO on emergency care was about 12 years ago, and it was really based on injury. And most of the other part of emergency care was not highlighted as well. And the national agenda now is universal health coverage. And we really wanted to frame emergency care as an essential part of universal health coverage. And if we think about it, emergency care is really the only specialty that provides care anytime, anywhere. So we wanted to, using the universal health coverage platform, we wanted to advocate and bring this discussion into the agenda. And eventually we wanted to get all the countries to buy in on this resolution and adopt it. And we do hope that all the countries would actually work towards implementing some of the suggestions through the resolution. And hopefully we'll find a way that we can implement some of the strategies that was outlined in the resolution.
The resolution that just was passed in Geneva was historic. Like this commitment to emergency care had never been voiced in the same way, had never been put in print, had never been policyized. I just made up that word.
So the last time that we had it was about 12 years ago. So this was, this puts it a little bit more definitive in a way what real emergency care should look like. It's really not about only trauma and injuries. There's so many complications of non-communicable diseases like diabetes and hypertension that we actually do address in the emergency department. Also complication of infectious diseases, and really about the timeliness of emergency care and the importance of emergency care within the national framework. So most of the time, the countries do fail to realize that. So we wanted to put that agenda forward. So in that way, most of the country, or what we call the member states within the UN system, to buy into this universal health coverage, emergency care is actually an essential part of universal health coverage. So in that way, they would include into their policies and into their strategies.
And when you say we, who's we?
So the Ministry of Health of Ethiopia, along with most of, when resolutions do actually pass, it has to be proposed by a country or what we call member states. So when I say we, it's my colleagues at the Ministry of Health who drafted and wrote this resolution and brought it forward to the WHO. So in that way, the rest of the countries or the member states adopt this resolution. So goes through several negotiations. There are some things that several countries or several nations, for example, when it comes to the financial risk protection or payment toward before medical care. So it goes through different negotiations and the different countries have to come up into an agreed text, and afterwards a resolution can be adopted. If a country refuses that resolution, it does not pass. So the negotiations are very vital. It's a very long and arduous process, but we made it happen and we're very excited about it.
Fantastic. It's amazing. So Ethiopia really put this forward to the world.
Yes. And along with Swaziland, now called Eswatini, they were members of the executive board. So we pushed for that. And once it went to the negotiation, all of the EU, which are and US and a few other countries co-sponsored it, and we brought it to the discussion, and over 28 countries actually spoke in support of the resolution from the floor on the day of the discussion, and it was able to be adopted without no amendment because of the agreed text that we've had.
Wow. Alyssa and Sian, how do you think being an advocate and wearing this hat, which is outside your main clinical environment, how does it make you a better physician?
So doing asylum work helps me to find meaning in medicine beyond treatment work. And this is a time where the medical world and the literature is rife with the concept of burnout. The concept of burnout is, I think, unfortunately limited and misdirected, where a lot of the solutions offered wind up being about doing more yoga and finding more time for my own meditation, when that's completely absurd because in general, it's the system that's causing physicians to run into trouble. It's the documentation. It's the extra alerts and reminders. It's not anything to do with me and what I'm doing. So I think it's an incredibly important time for physicians to make sure that we're keeping a touchstone to why we became physicians and why we found certain areas of medicine. For me, the asylum work is meaning making. It helps me to articulate my international ideas. It helps me to find connections in clinical work that are so different from treatment, where I have the ability to save a life or change a life in a very different way.
I think Alyssa said it all. I would say, I think being an emergency physician, every day I advocate for my patient. It might be a single patient in front of me, but also when I think of the international work that I do, it's really about advocating for population at a higher level. But I think going back to what Alyssa was saying, the discussion of the burnout and the discussion of clinical work being as not gratifying as it used to be. For me, when I do go back and work clinically, I think I do come back very rejuvenated, and I'm very thankful for the work that I do every day. And I also realize that the challenges that come at different levels and in different parts of the world. And it makes me appreciate the resources that I have here every day, and also the resources that I have from my colleagues. So it makes me become a better physician in a way, because it makes me a better advocate. Because when you go and advocate at an international level, unfortunately, there are lots of politics because you're dealing with so many stakeholders, you're fighting for the different resources that might be another department or another stakeholder is very interested in. So the fight at that level or the battle at that level is much more challenging. So when I do go back to my everyday challenges here, it makes me really do appreciate and really be thankful for the resources that I have. And I'm able to overcome those challenges every day.
We have been to have brought on two very smart, impactful, beautiful hearted mind people today on our program. Amy, what say you?
Since this episode is dedicated to A, I have two more A words.
Go.
The first one is awe, A-W-E. So I am in awe of the incredible things that these women do and what they're creating and their advocacy. And the second one is awe, A-H, like a relaxed sigh of relief. Because when I hear about what they're talking about, I feel this sense of relief. Like, these are my people. These are the people. These are the people that made me want to enter this profession and that will keep me going. So it's a sigh of relief.
Well, I want to take this time to thank both Alyssa and Sion for joining us, taking time out of their busy schedules to speak with us today, to give their own account, A account, for why they've been called to A advocacy, and specifically why advocacy can play a role in the very, very busy, very, very scheduled physician, because it gives you balance, it gives you perspective, and it resets you because you're using different skills, different part of your brain, and different, I would say, pieces of communication because of the challenge of certain places, certain people, certain populations. I do want to allow each of you to give us a final sort of 1 minute elevator summary of a message you'd like to leave the audience. Sion, why don't you take us from the top?
I think I'm going to go back to what I said at the very beginning. For me, I didn't realize that I had a voice or I was privileged until I started looking into issues or things that I was very interested in. And whoever might be listening to this, whether they're physicians or non-physicians, I do believe, actually, if you do have the privilege to listen to this podcast, you're already privileged. And there's something that you can do, naive as it might sound, but there are some things that you can do to change the world. And I challenge you to go get involved to whatever it is in your community that you can do. And you can be the voice for the voiceless and whatever you decide to do.
Fantastic. Alyssa?
How is someone supposed to talk after that? Come on.
You guys have been outdoing each other the whole program. We love it. And I are in awe. Awe.
So in terms of meaning making, I think it's always interesting to ask and find out why somebody gets where they are in their life. And my mother was a refugee in Philadelphia. I grew up with her refugee stories and her stories of resettlement. She had difficulty, a really hard time adjusting in America. They changed her name from Kayla to Caroline. She had some subtle physical disabilities, including strabismus, and had a really hard time because of social difficulty. So I thought I went into this work because of these nerdtastic scientific clinical interests of mine, but it turns out it's really all about my mother. And Freud's somewhere giggling right now because this psychiatrist says, it's always about your mother. I think that every physician needs to find something where they can do the healing for themselves and for their family. And for me, this work is that. And this is my issue. It doesn't have to be everyone's issue, but I compel all the emergency medicine physicians listening to find your issue and find your way to heal yourself and your family.
Thank you, Alyssa. Thank you, Sion. Omaseganalu, that's thank you in Amharic. Amy, you want to take this out?
No, I don't want this to stop. Until next time.
Okay, audience, thank you for listening to our episode, and we'll talk to you soon.